Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Motor Talk with Toby Hagen.
Toby Hagen is back with us for Motor Talk Thursday, 1-300-800-222, or as many people already are, you can text in any questions, any comments on 0467 922 702. Toby, welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks, Nick. Hello.
Got to ask, we're getting a little echo. That's annoying. Elon Musk reckons that the Tesla Model Y is the world's best-selling car of 2025. It does sound like there's some big doubts on that. Where's the controversy happening?
Oh, the controversy's happening around Toyota, basically. So, look, the Model Y is one of the biggest selling cars in the world, and in 2023 it was undisputed as the number one selling car. First time I think an EV's done that. 2024, it sort of was very close, and I think a lot of people have accepted it was probably the best-selling car again then. But this time around, Elon Musk has come out and said, well, we're the number one selling car again for 2025. The problem is the rest of the brands haven't yet released their sales figures, and the expectation is that the Toyota RAV4 will probably pip it. So it's probably done a little bit better. Unfortunately, we're not going to know all those sales figures for another probably a month or two by the time they collate them from the various markets around the world. But the short story is he's probably a fraction premature in coming out and saying it is the top-selling car for 2025.
Toby, outside of that, though, what have EV sales been like for last year?
Look, I guess there's been a lot of chat about EVs coming off in various markets, but interestingly, when you look at them globally, they're actually up to the point, you know, round about 20-odd%, depending on the market you're looking at. There's obviously one market where they're heading in the opposite direction, and that is the US. Huh. I guess if you look at the policies that Trump has brought in terms of getting rid of the electric car incentives and heading much more down the internal combustion engine route, or back down that route, then obviously, I guess no surprise that it is heading in the wrong direction over there. But China, which is the world's biggest car market, is huge in terms of EVs, and their market did grow for electric vehicles, as did Europe. So, you know, two big markets have gone up, and also a lot of the Asian countries, some significant growth in admittedly smaller markets, but still heading in the right direction. Things like Vietnam and Thailand, for example, Singapore, all jumping up in terms of EV sales. So overall, EV sales are up. But it's still fair to say that not nearly as, not where a lot of people thought they might be when they were predicting it a few years ago, that the expectation was that the growth could have been bigger than it is now.
Toby, is a lot of that due to how tricky it's been in the US? I mean, has that traditionally been a pretty big market?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, until, 12, 14 years ago, the US was the single biggest market in the world. China's overtaken it. But yeah, look, that is one of the challenges. But I think there are broader challenges here, and that is, getting people to accept the new technology. There have obviously been price issues in terms of EVs have had price premiums on them, the charging infrastructure and so on. So there's a lot of question marks that a lot of people have. And some segments of the market do struggle with electric vehicles. So the obvious one is commercial vehicles that are doing potentially big kilometres in Australia, where 20-odd% of our market is utes. A lot of people have big expectations of their utes. They want to use them in remote areas. They get used for a lot of work purposes, and they do a lot of towing. And they're all things that at this stage aren't necessarily brilliantly set up for EVs. I think they'll get there, but it's going to be a little while yet, and particularly convincing, I guess, the traditional customer base that they're going to get the job done as they have in the past.
I think we keep getting told it's going to get there, and then we'll see really good models like that F-150 Lightning from Ford. But isn't that being knocked on the head now because of how bad sales have been in the US?
Yeah, sure is, and that's one of the things. I mean, We call them utes, they call them pickup trucks over there, and we saw this enormous surge towards electric pickup trucks. Led by the F-150 Lightning, and obviously the Tesla Cybertruck then came along. It hasn't sold in anything like the numbers that Tesla was expecting. Chevrolet did some, did electric versions of its Silverado and so on, and Ram is also planning some EV versions. But what they're now saying, as you say, that as you pointed out, they've knocked it on the head. They're saying they're not going to do the fully electric Lightning anymore. they're heading towards what they call range extender EVs. So what they effectively are is an electric vehicle. So they've still got the electric motor, they've got the battery pack, they can still drive in EV mode, but they also have an engine there that can recharge the battery for longer trips. So I guess giving people that peace of mind that if they do need to tow heavy loads, if they do need to cover big distances, they can still do it with good old petrol. So I think we're going to see a fair few of those sort of plug-in hybrids or range extenders to try and, I guess, bridge the gap towards fully electric commercial vehicles down the track. And that's certainly where the US market's going. They're very much going down that path in terms of those range extenders, starting with Ford.
Toby, I want to talk a bit about what's been happening in Australia, but we've got so many questions on the text line coming in. I feel like I should clear a couple of these for you. Kylie in Bega says, can you ask Toby if a Kona left parked in the sun all day on a 38-degree day could cause the electronics to disconnect? It went haywire. We had to take it back to the dealer to rejig everything. They were unsure if that could be the problem, but it was the only thing that seemed to have been different on that day to any other day.
Yeah, right. Short story is, if that is what caused the issue, then there's another issue with the car, because cars these days, I mean, they're tested in extreme, far more extreme heat than that. Car makers typically test them in 50 plus degrees, and they'll often leave them, they'll soak them in the sun or simulate that sort of heat, and often with high humidity as well, sometimes for days, and then and they do this the same with extreme cold as well. So no, a 38 degree day parking a car in the sun, any car should deal with that fine. As I said, even 50 odd degrees they should be able to deal with. So should not be the issue. I suspect there's something else going on there, which may well have been triggered by the heat, but it's there's something else that's also going on.
John in Canberra says, Happy New Year. A very Happy New Year to you, of course. We're all on the same page now. We've all managed to get through the first day of the new year. But John in Canberra says, any updates, Toby, regarding conversions for diesel vehicles to full electric? I got my Hilux brand new 10 years ago, and I love the idea of it maybe truly going forever.
Look, there are a fair few companies that do this, both in Australia and around the world. So there is a bit of a boutique market there for EV conversions of anything, pretty much, and we've seen it with everything from classic cars and some old classics, Jaguar E-types and stuff like that. A lot of old Land Rovers and some old Land Cruisers and so on getting converted as well. The challenge is the price. So it's it used to be, I'm saying, early in the COVID years, so call it four or five years ago, it was sort of $40,000 plus for a conversion. I think these days it's sort of $60,000 or $70,000 plus. And if you want a decent one, you're probably well into six figures. So it's it's probably not the sort of thing you're gonna do with a car just to tide it over for another few years or get another 10 or 20 years out of it. If you've got a classic that you want to keep going for another 20 or 30 years, then yeah, maybe you'll do that. But keep in mind as well, there's an electric Hilux coming next year from the factory. You'll be able to buy it from a dealership. The expectation is that the range, the distance between charges, will only be 260-odd kilometres, so not super long. It's mainly been aimed at fleets, particularly mining fleets and so on. But, that car's going to come, as I said, out of the factory with full Toyota backing and everything, full EV version. We haven't got the price yet, but I suspect it'll be cheaper than doing a conversion of your old one.
I've got many, many texts coming in, so don't be afraid to give a call. Jump the queue, even 1-300-800-222. It is Motor Talk Thursday, and Toby is more than happy to take a couple of questions. Toby, I've got to ask. Now, I hear that the government is saying in Australia it's going to review the electric car discount policy, which has been giving some pretty generous tax exemptions on EVs. What's that likely to end up looking like?
Yeah, we don't quite know yet. I mean, the government's put out a statement saying that, yeah, they're going to look at it sometime this year, and I suspect it'll happen earlier in the year, partly because there's been enormous uptake of this thing. So there are various components to it, but the biggest one is a fringe benefits tax exemption on EVs that are under the luxury car tax threshold, so roughly under $90,000. And a lot of the brands are reporting that, around half of buyers are utilising that by going on a novated lease and effectively saving thousands of dollars a year in terms of that FBT exemption. So it's costing the government essentially more than they initially planned for. So they're saying, do we need to wind it back? So we haven't heard exactly what that will entail. other than they're looking to review it pretty shortly. So, you know, I think the expectation is that they probably will wind it back, or at least announce the dates that they'll, you know, maybe bring it forward, or say that they'll bring it or finish it a little bit sooner than they maybe had initially planned. So potentially some changes kicking around there, which will be interesting to see how it all pans out.
I mean, has it been a big driver of sales in Australia?
Yeah, I think definitely, because you know, particularly in that that leasing market. So when someone goes to get a new car through their work and does a novated lease, and they suddenly start looking at the figures, and a lot of them are figuring out that they can essentially buy an electric car or pay another $20,000 for an electric car and get have the same sort of expenditure that they would have on a petrol or a diesel car. So a lot of them are heading towards that, and as I said, banking the savings. Which is, you know, which is costing the government, as I said, plenty in terms of what would normally be, people would normally have to pay that fringe benefits tax, and with the EVs they don't have to. So it's, so yeah, I think it's an enormous uptake and been significant in the growth of EVs. I mean, EVs in Australia, we're looking at a little bit under 10% in terms of market penetration for full battery electric vehicles. So yeah, I mean, it's you know, even if as I said, if half of them are going on that that novated lease, that FBT exemption, then it's a significant number.
Toby, I'll run through some more questions in a second from people on the text line 0467 922 702. It is Motor Talk Thursday. Toby Hagen, very happy to take a few calls or a few texts as well. But while we're talking about government reviews, EU backing down from a full internal combustion engine car ban for 2035.
This was a pretty big one. I mean, this was something that a lot of the car makers started pushing back on. The European Union came out and said that in 2035 there would be a ban on internal combustion engines. And a lot of the manufacturers have pointed out that is going to be very difficult. And I guess there's some specialist cases, you know, high performance supercars and so on, where they're saying, you know, we'd love to keep the thrill and the sound of an engine, of a big engine, big capacity, high revving engine. But so, yeah, the European Union's backed down and said that they won't ban them now, and you can still sell internal combustion engines beyond that. There is a slight catch, though, which is that they're saying that they need to emit at least 90% fewer emissions than they did from 2021 levels. So that what that essentially means is that any internal combustion engines beyond that time will need some form of electrification. Hybrid, for example, to try and reduce the emissions to be able to meet those future standards. But a significant back down that you know, even 2 years ago, I don't think anyone saw coming, but it's sort of heading that way now.
Peter in Kingsford takes it in saying, which is better, plug-in hybrid or standard hybrid? Which medium hybrid SUVs are on your recommendation list?
Yeah, this is a tricky one because I've never been a massive fan of plug-in hybrids because they're a little bit compromised, because you end up having essentially two powertrains. You've got the full electric side of it, and a lot of people say, I'm looking at a plug-in hybrid because I don't travel far, I don't do big distances. And for me, that's exactly the wrong reason to buy a plug-in hybrid. If you don't do big distances and you want an electrified vehicle, get a full battery electric vehicle, much better option. Where a plug-in hybrid really works is if you need to do big kilometres. So if you're driving regularly, say, you know, 600, 800, 1,000 kilometres a day, that's where they start to make more sense, because for your around town running, for your everyday, you can still drive them as an electric vehicle, but you've got that petrol backup for longer trips. So yeah, I think that's where they make more sense. We're seeing now from some of the Chinese manufacturers a real shift in terms of how those plug-in hybrids work. So essentially what they're doing is putting in bigger battery packs and bigger electric motors. So they're driving more and more like an EV, but still with that backup of a petrol engine in the background there. So so some of the newer ones are going pretty well. So I guess where I'm going with that is which one's best, it really depends on your use case. If you're looking at, and a plug-in hybrid would generally cost more as well, so you're paying more for the bigger battery and so on. So, yeah, as I said, I would only really recommend plug-in hybrids to people who are doing regularly big kilometres or towing, you know, needing that, you know, the Ford Ranger plug-in hybrid, for example, has got, you know, it still allows you to tow 3.5 tonnes. You can still do everything you can with a normal Ranger, but you've got the electric motor there for everyday around town running.
Toby, I keep hearing that some people are using their electric cars as sort of a house battery as well, using it to store a little bit of power, having it as part of that whole setup there. Is that common, and can you do that with a hybrid?
You can with one hybrid. The Mitsubishi Outlander plug-in hybrid does have what they call vehicle-to-grid, V2G, where you can feed back into the grid. Huh. It's been a long time coming in Australia, so you need to put hardware on your house as well to be able to enable that that functionality. So, yes, it is available in a hybrid. As I said, that Mitsubishi Outlander does it. There's only one battery electric vehicle in the country currently that does it, which is the Nissan Leaf. But there's a lot more coming. Certainly a lot of manufacturers, Hyundai, Kia and others, are looking at it. And I believe some people have done software tweaks to their cars in Australia, I think with some Kias and so on, to try and enable that. But the car makers are obviously nervous of having anything aftermarket done with that sort of that sort of technology. So we'll see a lot more of it in future. We're going to see, I think, in the next few years, a bit of a boom in that vehicle-to-grid capability, but it's not common at the moment. But watch this space, there's a lot more coming.
Is it your sense that it's what people want? Are people looking for that feature?
I think some people are certainly very interested in it. I mean, the challenge with vehicle to grid is, I guess, where it makes most sense is if you're charging the car from solar, so effectively free electricity off your rooftop, then that works brilliantly. And then you can obviously, when the sun goes down in the afternoon or in the evening, you can then use the car to power your house. The challenge with that is most people will want to use their car sometime during the day, so it might not be sitting there able to be charged during the day. So it's not going to suit everyone. But if you start looking, I mean, you look at home batteries that people are putting on their houses, and, you know, most people are putting somewhere between, say, 10 to 20 or 30 kilowatt hours worth of battery capacity on their house. Some people are certainly going bigger, but most are hovering around there. Well, your average electric car, your Tesla, for example, your average Tesla's roughly 60 kilowatt hours, so double the size of a decent sized battery, house battery. And some electric cars go over 100 kilowatt hours of battery capacity. So you've got enormous energy storage in the cars, much more than most people are putting on their houses. So the potential is pretty strong in terms of being able to feed that back in and take advantage or lower your energy prices, basically.
It is Motor Talk Thursday. Toby's around for the whole first hour. If you've got questions, you can text him in 0467 922 702. You can call as well. Andrew's in Bunbury. Andrew, welcome to Nightlife.
G'day, guys. I'm loving the show. Thank you.
What did you want to ask Toby?
Toby, I've seen online that in China there's a Geely EX5 being released with a bigger capacity battery. I'm just wondering if that's coming to Australia anytime soon, because we're looking to purchase one in later this month.
Yeah, right, okay. Yeah, you're right. They actually pronounce it Geely, not Geely, but yeah, there is the bigger batteries on the way out. I'm not exactly sure when it's getting here, but yes, you can pretty much guarantee that it will make it to Australia, is the expectation. Often these Chinese brands don't give you a whole lot of notice in terms of exactly when they'll arrive in dealerships, but I think the expectation there is that we will get the bigger battery pack at some time, at some point in Australia. The challenge is that car's obviously playing at the more affordable end of the EV market, sort of in that $40,000 to $45,000 bracket. And once you put a bigger battery in, obviously generally prices will increase. But we've also seen so much competition at that end of the market that I guess trying to step up the range, how far you get between a charge, is one of the big sales pitches, and that's something that could certainly help with that model. So I would expect it at some point in the next few months. I wouldn't exactly know when, though, is the challenge.
Andrew, is that brand sort of particularly appealing to you for any reason, or is it just something you've had your eye on?
We test drove one about a month ago. The amount of tech, the quality of the car, it was a solid car. We compared it to an MG S5, I'm not sure if that's correct, and that just felt like a rattle box. it drove well. It just seemed to be the right amount of features for the sale price.
Yeah, Andrew, good luck with it as well. And Toby, is this the same brand that might be bringing in a cheaper model into the Aussie market as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So Geely has, well, that's the EX5, which is sort of small to mid-sized SUV. They're bringing out another one called the EX2, and they have confirmed that. I think it's around March or April next year for that car. So that's a smaller SUV. They haven't announced pricing, but the expectation is it'll slide in probably under $30,000. So it's going to be pretty sharp pricing in that electric car market. When you look at, you know, entry level Toyotas, Mazdas, for example, these days all start over that. So it's getting in some pretty sharp pricing. But yeah, that car will be out, I think, in a few months.
Is that going to be one? That is like going to be one of the cheaper on the market in that case, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So the cheapest EV on the market now is the BYD Atto 1, just $23,990 plus on roads. So I don't think the EX2 will quite get down to that, but it's going to have to be somewhere in the ballpark to be competitive, because obviously, you know, playing at that end of the market, price is such an important part. And as that caller touched on, you know, the quality, the I think this is the thing that sort of surprises a lot of people with these Chinese brands, is that they don't feel cheap. You could argue that probably the worst thing on the car is the brand, because Australians are not familiar with the brand. If it had a more familiar brand on it, they might be bigger sellers. But yeah, the actual presentation, the quality and the features, and often these days, the safety systems and so on tend to be all pretty strong.
Toby Hagen is in for the regular Motor Talk Thursday. If you have any questions, you can call in on 1300 800 222. He's going to stick around for the rest of this hour. 0467 922 702 on the text line. I will get to some texts as well. You can always call and jump the queue. John's in Geelong. John, welcome to Nightlife.
Yeah, how you going?
I'm good. What do you want to ask?
The Mercedes, four-wheel drive, they look like a Land Cruiser troop carrier. Has Toby driven one of them? They've got, apparently got a new straight six in them, a 3-litre turbo diesel. And, yeah, they're coming out next year. I was wondering if Toby has driven one of them.
Toby, you been behind the wheel?
So this is the G-Wagon, the Galanda wagon, which is the boxy, utilitarian sort of hardcore off-roader. I have driven them. I haven't driven the latest updated one, that one with the inline six-cylinder engine, but I've driven the V8 twin turbo, the G63 versions. I've driven very briefly the electric version. They've got a full electric version as well, but not that that other upgraded one. But it's interesting because that G-Wagon initially came out in, the original G-Wagon was 1979. It first came out, and until about 6 years ago, 6 or 7 years ago, essentially that old model kept going until then. So it was feeling pretty tired. They did an all-new version, and the all-new version essentially looks exactly the same as the previous one, but it is a very different car beneath the skin, so a much, much better car to drive, better in terms of the packaging. So the comfort levels and space and so on in the cabin were also a lot better. So, it was a huge step up when they did that that second generation model, as I said, about 6 or 7 years ago.
John, hopefully that helps out with you. Couple of texts on the text line for Toby. Cole, also in Geelong, says, Toby, I bought a new Outlander in 2015. I'm thinking of buying the 2025 ES model, the two-wheel drive. It's just a hair under 40K, $39,990. I haven't had any problems with my Mitsubishi vehicles. What are your thoughts on that new model?
The current Outlander, the new, it'll be the next generation from that 2015 one that you're in, is a little bit more Nissan than Mitsubishi. So the engine in it, for example, is a Nissan engine. It's a it's all part of the Nissan Renault Mitsubishi alliance. So it'll be, as I said, more Nissan than Mitsubishi, and as it's not a bad thing. I'm just pointing out that it's don't go expecting it to be fully Mitsubishi. And Nissan certainly has a great reputation as well for reliability and longevity. So wouldn't have an issue from that perspective. But don't ignore the Nissan X-Trail, which is essentially the same car underneath. It's got the same engine and same componentry and so on, suspension componentry. The big difference is in, obviously, the body. It's a different body on top of each one. And then you come down to things like pricing and features and so on, and there will be little differences with that as well.
We'll come back to a few questions at the moment, but one thing I did want to ask you is, obviously everyone wants to know that they are driving a safe car, and people are usually looking at stuff like the ANCAP crash testing. Something's gone a little bit odd recently that has highlighted maybe one of the issues there.
Yeah, that's right. There's so the Mitsubishi ASX recently scored 4 stars in ANCAP crash testing. So this was obviously they recommend that you get a car with as many stars as possible. And they came out and said, well, the ASX only gets 4 stars, whereas, you know, most cars these days we tend to see 5 stars in them. The challenge is that it is essentially a rebadged Renault Captur. So, again, coming back to that sharing that we're seeing and this so-called badge engineering, particularly with that car, that Mitsubishi ASX is very much a Renault in everything but badge. And the Renault scored 5 stars. So it's a 5-star car that it was a 5-star car until yesterday. Today it actually has expired, so it's technically unrated. But as of yesterday, it was a 5-star car. And yeah, it's exactly the same car in terms of how it crashes and how it performs in a crash test. But one gets 5 stars, the other gets 4.
Has there been any comment from ANCAP on this at all?
I haven't seen anything on it. All they point to is the date stamp. So they say check when the car was tested. So in terms of that Renault was tested in 2019, for example, whereas the Mitsubishi was last year. So yeah, they say look at the date stamp and get a car with the most recent date stamp if you can. But the reality is a lot of people are looking at these crash test ratings and they just purely look at the star rating and say, okay, that's 5 stars. That's 4 stars. I'll get the one that's 5 stars. Particularly, and this comes down to fleets and government departments and so on, often have stipulations that they will only buy a 5-star car. So in that situation, they're potentially pointing themselves towards a 5-star car that is identical to a 4-star car in terms of its crash performance.
We are talking through cars, talking through everything about cars, to be honest. It's Motor Talk Thursday, 1300 800 222, otherwise texting in on 0467 922 702. My name is Nick Healy, with you right around the nation on Nightlife, filling in for Phil while he has a bit of a break on this one. Jane in Richmond's got a question in that's a bit similar to something that's been on my mind. I've got a bit of an older car as well that's sitting around that 20-year mark. Jane's saying, I've got a Honda HR-V from 2001. It's done, 166,000 kilometres plus, but it runs very well. I grew up in a full driveway service station, so I know how to look after it. Wondering if I should keep it or move on to an EV. And I think there'd be a few people, Toby, who are just sort of asking, you know, when is that changeover point? Should we be taking the cars we've currently got and basically running them till they don't move anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit of a fan of, if you've got a car that you know its history, you know it's still got plenty of life left in it, then give it another year or two or three, like stick with it. Obviously, you're going to miss out on some things, you know, gains and the changes we've seen in safety technology, even over the last 3 or 4 years, but certainly over the last couple of decades, has been enormous, not only in terms of crash performance, so how the car performs in a crash, but also how it performs in trying to avoid the crash in the first place. So there's enormous changes in that, and any newer car will, doesn't matter what brand you pick, will be better than a 2001 model. As I said, if you know the car, if you know what's going on with it, then I'd be inclined to stick with it for the moment, because you can guarantee that in the next year or two, we're going to see enormous changes again with the amount of EVs and so on sale. And it was only, you looked 2 or 3 years ago, I think it was 2 years ago, we had 56 electric vehicles on the market. We've now got 160 on the market. And, the expectation is that that'll surge well over 200 by the end of this year. And you'll have many more choices, I think, if you can hold on to that car you've got now for another year or two.
Jay, my only advice would be, my car, your car has a CD stacker in the boot, don't forget to get the CDs out before you do end up trading it in. 6 CD stacker. I'll be very sad to say goodbye to that. 1300 800 222. Carmen's called in. Carmen, welcome to Nightlife.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. Toby, what's your question for Toby?
Well, I've got a 2014 Prado VX diesel that's done about 150,000 kilometres. There's nothing that's gone wrong with it, but I'm wondering if there would be any potential issues to be wary of and whether it might be wise to upgrade to a later model.
How many Ks?
150,000.
150. I mean, that's just a baby, that thing. Like, it's, you look at Toyota diesels and they'll often, you see them for sale, they've often got 300,000, 400,000, 500,000 Ks on them. So, look, any car that's 10 plus years old and done a few Ks, clearly things can go wrong. But those, all the Toyota heavy-duty off-roaders, like Prados, Land Cruisers, Hiluxes and so on, have six-month, 10,000-kilometre service intervals, so they get them back to the dealership quite regularly. I'd certainly been making sure that I'd be getting it serviced according to the service book. But, you know, any car of that age, things can go wrong, but it should have, if it's been well looked after, it should have plenty of Ks left in it yet. So, in terms of longevity and reliability, Toyota's got a pretty solid reputation, and that engine in that car, the 3-litre four-cylinder turbo diesel, you know, it's a pretty solid engine. They've since upgraded to a 2.8-litre, but that one was pretty solid back then.
Carmen, are you happy with it still?
Yeah, no, I love it. It's a great car. I know I was getting a bit, maybe I might be getting a bit old like me. what is the I was just going to ask Toby too about the 2.8 litre motor in the later models. Has that worked out well, or is that any issues with that?
Oh, there was, they've had some issues with it here and there with DPF, diesel particulate filters and so on, but it was a better engine. So it downsized in terms of capacity, but it improved in terms of power and torque. They did an upgrade on it as well and ended up getting it these days. It's roughly, 150 kilowatts, 500 newton meters. So call it 10 to 20%. Up on in terms of performance and so on off your engine. So, but again, reliable engine. I mean, it's soldered on well. As I said, they had some issues with DPFs, but they solved that with what they call a manual DPF burn off. So, a diesel particulate filter, as you may know, is a self cleaning filter. So, when the exhaust system, or after a certain amount of driving, the exhaust system will then heat up and burn off all the soot and so on that it's collected out of the exhaust emissions to then clean everything up. But you need to get it up to that temperature. You need to drive it for, say, 20 minutes, half an hour on a freeway or something, or at higher speeds, 60 plus kilometres an hour, to try and get that temperature in there. So what Toyota found was some people were not getting the temperature in the exhaust, and then they were having issues with the DPF failing. So they ended up putting in this manual burn-off, so you could then burn it off whenever you wanted. You could press a button and have the car do the burn-off when you chose to do it, which then ensures that it all works fine. So once they bought that in, that solved one of the big issues they had with that engine, but generally it's been pretty solid.
Carmen, hopefully that helps out. It's Motor Talk Thursday. Toby Hagen in, helping out with any of the questions you might have. 1-300-800-222. Toby, Andrew on the Gold Coast saying, well, love your work, so congratulations. Not sure if you've already chatted about it, but what are your thoughts on the Toyota BZEV? Andrew says that new model looks like a much better car to me.
Yeah, this was there's a few BZs. BZ standing for Beyond Zero, so it's Toyota's sort of sub branding for their EVs. But the BZ4X, which is the car we've had now for 2 odd years in Australia, been an extremely slow seller. It hasn't performed well at all in terms of, you know, coming from the biggest selling brand. I guess we've expected, a few of us probably expected a little bit more in terms of sales. It's been a very slow seller, but the updated model, which is it's just started arriving. I think they sort of started rolling out in the last month or so. They effectively knocked $10,000 off it and put some more features in it and made it gave it more range between charges. So a big step up on where it was, for sure. I haven't driven that updated model yet, but it's on paper, it certainly looks a lot sharper than what it was before. And it needed to be because, as I said, it was off the pace. It wasn't selling in the numbers that a big brand like Toyota would expect. And you would anticipate that the new one would go a little bit better. That said, you'd look at the big sellers in that EV market, and Toyota's got a lot of catching up to do at this stage.
10K, nothing to be sniffed at.
No, that's right. And that goes against the grain of, you know, pretty much every other Toyota. You know, you look at the recent ones, a little bit over a year ago, they brought out the new Prado. Toyota just announced the new, the pricing on the new Hilux about a month ago, and the new RAV4, which comes out in a couple of months. And all of those stepped up in price quite significantly, you know, 5%, sometimes 10% in terms of the price jump, which does a couple of things. First of all, it makes the used cars more appealing because suddenly someone looking at a new one says, oh, hang on, I don't quite want to stretch the budget, so I might just buy a near new one. So it props up your used car values a little bit. And it's all of a sudden, without that, you've got you've got a lot of people saying, well, suddenly the BZ4X is $10,000 cheaper, so they don't have that advantage there with that one.
Rod's called in from Gippsland. Rod, welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you very much. Tobe, I've been listening to the program for 40 years. Consequently, your dad wished to do it. How, I just wondered how he was going.
He's going all right, yeah. Caught up with him over Christmas, and he's all going fine. Still.
Thank you very much. The reason I rang, I've got a Bravo 96 manufacturer. It's done 490,000 kilometres, and I'm on a farm, and a lot of the maintenance I do myself. The question at the back of my mind is, with electric cars coming in, do you reckon the government will ever force people who've got cars of my vintage and petrol motors will be forced off the road?
No, short story. So so even now, I mean, if you look at, you know, you can still today legally drive a car without seatbelts if the car didn't have seatbelts fitted. So you go back to a 1920s or a 1930s car, and they haven't forced those cars off the road. Obviously, what has naturally happened is those cars get so old, there are better alternatives, newer alternatives that most people want to go to. But if you still want a car from 50, 60, 70 years ago, you can still buy one, you can still drive it, even though the regulations change. So the safety regulations, the emissions regulations, all that sort of stuff, even though that changes, those cars are still fine to have on the road. And I don't think it'll be any different with EVs and petrol and diesel cars moving forward. I think in 50, 100 years, I think most of the technology, most people will be driving electric vehicles of some sort. But if you still want to have an old car for whatever reason, then no, I don't think there'll be anyone forcing it off the road. And obviously in your situation, it's not on the road by the sounds of it, it's on your property. So theoretically you can do what you want.
Rod, fingers crossed that it'll all be okay for you. Jodie's called in from Currumbin. Jodie, welcome to Nightlife.
Hello, thank you. I'm enjoying the show as well.
Oh, cool.
I wanted to ask, I drive a Subaru Outback Turbo, and it's the 50-year anniversary model, and I'm looking at buying my first caravan. I was just curious as to how strict you need to be with the tear and the average towing.
What was the model again?
It's the 50-year anniversary edition, so it's the Outback Turbo, is it 2023, I think?
So the XT being the turbocharged model, you have to be very strict with your weights and so on towing. So there are a significant number of people who are overloaded on towing, and I think a lot of people don't realise how easy it is to overload. So there's a few key figures you've got to look at. One is your gross vehicle mass, so how much weight the car can take, because the minute you put a trailer on the back, it's pushing down on the back of the car, and typically it's around about 10% of the weight of your trailer goes onto the back of the car. So you've got to take that into account. You've got to take into account your gross combination mass, so that's the weight of everything, your trailer, your caravan, your people, luggage, fuel, the whole bit. And then you've got to look at axle loads and so on as well, so how much is pushing down on each axle. So extremely important to do those calculations, not just from a legal perspective, but also from a safety perspective, because the car makers do put in a lot of effort into braking systems, the suspension systems, all those components in there are designed to work up to a maximum capacity. If you go taking the car beyond that, then it's an issue. And it's particularly an issue if you're doing it, in high temperatures, for example. So suddenly, it's a 40 plus degree day. You got the car loaded up. Well, your tyres, for example, are going to get hotter. And if you've overloaded everything, then you can potentially build up more heat in the tyres and end up with tyre failure. So there's a whole bunch of things that can go wrong. The other thing you need to be aware of with most Subarus, and I'm pretty sure your Outback will be the same, is they have a maximum recommended towing speed limit of 80 kilometres an hour. So most manufacturers will allow you to go up to what the legal limit is, and typically around Australia it's 100 or 110, depending on the weight of the trailer and what state or territory you're in. But most Subarus, as I said, have an 80k an hour speed limit on them when you're towing, so be aware of that as well.
Juddy, I'll just recommend, if you don't have the ABC Listen app, download it, because I think it was Tuesday last week we did a really big chat with an expert in caravanning who went in a little bit into why this is so important, some of the safety stuff he considers from that angle as well. It's probably worth going back and having a listen to. Nerida and Tweed Heads. Nerida, welcome to Nightlife.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
What did you want to ask Toby?
Toby, I've got a Toyota Prado VX, 19 years old, very strict in regard to car servicing. I got 400,000 out of the driving it, and I just had to totally replace everything under the bonnet. The engine died.
Wow.
It's how many Ks?
400,000.
400,000, yeah. I'm trying to figure, was that the 4-litre or the either a 2.7-litre petrol or 4-litre petrol?
No, it's the big one, VX Grande.
But engine-wise, I'm trying to figure out the engine. Is it petrol or diesel, basically?
It's petrol.
Petrol, okay, cool. So it'll be the 4-litre V6, yeah. So, obviously, you know, cars do have a lifespan and they will eventually get to that point of saying I've had enough or something will potentially go wrong. But, and often it's the diesels in the Toyotas that seem to go a bit longer. That said, that 4-litre V6 has been used in plenty of models in Australia and it tends to soldier on pretty well. So I'm sort of surprised to hear that. But equally, things can go wrong. And, you know, with a car with 400,000 Ks on it, it's done a fair bit of work over its time. So I'm not completely surprised, but I also wouldn't be surprised if someone said they got 600,000 out of it. You know, they can those engines can certainly do that.
Nerida, thanks for calling in on that one. Hopefully that was helpful. And Deborah in Hobart, with the question that's been on my mind as well. Deborah, welcome to Nightlife.
Hi, thank you.
Oh, Deborah, you're breaking up a little bit. Hopefully we'll get you. That's okay. I might have to leave you, unfortunately. We're not getting a very good call on that one. But I do know, Toby, Deborah was kind of asking about the secondhand EV market, but also battery life, particularly when it comes to current EVs.
Yeah, cool. So secondhand EV market as a general rule, the residual values, the resale values have not held up as well as particularly hybrids. Hybrids these days are the darlings of the used car market. But it sort of depends where you look and how old the car was, because the prices we've seen of new EVs, as we touched on with that Toyota before, have all come down. The minute you lower the price of a new EV, it tends to impact the used car market as well. So, but I find typically the more value focused EVs that are playing in, say, the sub $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 market, they tend to hold up reasonably well on the used car market. As I said, not as good as a hybrid or something. But the more expensive ones, particularly luxury ones over $100,000, have been hit pretty hard in terms of resale values. But battery life is the other one, and this is something that a lot of people, I think, are a bit concerned about, is when do I have to replace the battery on my electric car? And the short story is you shouldn't have to replace the battery on your electric car, because as with an engine, it's designed to last the life of the car. And, you know, if it fails at 15 or 20 years old, there's a very good chance you're going to be better off buying a new car rather than replacing the battery in it. And keep in mind that almost all EVs have at least an 8-year warranty on the battery. Some of them have a 10-year unlimited kilometre warranty on the battery. So they've got, decent backup there. When that warranty runs out, it doesn't mean that you need to suddenly put a new battery in there, similar with an engine. You know, most engines have got a 5 or, say, 7-year warranty on them. You don't need a new engine at the end of that warranty. It just means that the warranty's run out. So, typically they'll last longer than that. There was a study came out only in the last couple of weeks, I think it was, about battery degradation, because all batteries, whether they're in a phone, a computer, a car, whatever, will lose their ability to hold charge over time. But most of the car makers are finding that they're losing less charge than they initially anticipated. So it's the last study I saw suggested about 1.8% per year of capacity, I've seen other studies suggest 1 to 1.5%, but let's take that worst case scenario, 1.8%. You know, after 10 years, you will have lost 18% of the original capacity of the battery. You know, keep in mind, your average petrol or diesel engine after 10 years of driving is not going to be like it was when it came out of the factory brand new. So there's degradation of everything over time.
Deborah, hopefully that's helpful. Sorry that we couldn't get you through with that phone line. My apologies. Eye on the time. We've got a couple of minutes before the ABC News. We'll take Andy as a last call. Andy, welcome to Nightlife.
Hi, how are you going, guys?
I'm good. What do you want to ask Toby?
Yeah, look, I've got a VT Commodore, so a 2000 model. I had some issues with my engine, so I built a 6-litre LS2. With a 4-inch crank, hardened push rods, double valve springs, all the bits and pieces, 6-speed manual, true track diff with 3.9 gears, and it doesn't matter what gear I grab, it seems to be chirping tyres. Can you help me with that?
You've got too much power, basically, right?
Too much power?
Yeah, and about 800.
What's that, 800 horsepower?
Yeah, 800 at the rear wheels.
Right. Well, yeah, I think the challenge you got there is a lot of power. You know, you look at these days, cars have typically got bigger and heavier. You know, the VT obviously then went in 2006 to the VE model, which was a bigger, heavier car than the VT and VX and VZs and so on before it. And so suddenly you've got a very high-powered engine in a fairly lightweight car. In terms of getting that power to the ground, I mean, with that specific case, I wouldn't have a clue, to be honest. I mean, it's obviously everything from the things you've talked about, differentials and so on, tyres, suspension system in terms of dampers and so on can all play a part there. But, you know, any time you're putting big power in a in an older car, there are going to be other engineering challenges that pop up. And often car makers will, you know, limit on a new car, they'll limit things like maximum output, sometimes in certain gears, to try and make them, I guess, more drivable every day rather than just unleash the maximum amount of power the whole time. But yeah, I dare say that's a challenge for someone a bit more engineering than me in terms of someone who would know that modified car market a little bit better.
Andy, good luck with it and thanks for calling in. And just in 30 seconds before I have to say goodbye to you, Toby, what are you having a play with at the moment? What are you driving?
I've actually been driving the Deepal EO7, which people will be saying, what's a Deepal? And Deepal is another one of these new Chinese brands. And the EO7 is a car they call the multi-truck. So it can actually sort of switch between an SUV and a ute. It's a lot more SUV than it is ute. I actually took it up to a farm and loaded it up with hay bales to do the ute test. And it did all right, but it's not a traditional ute. But it's pretty cool the way it does convert the back end of the car. A lot of electric motors and sliding glass and folding doors and everything to try and convert it into a ute. But as I said, not traditional ute in terms of the payload and the amount of space you got there. But it does it to some extent.
Well, Toby, thank you so much for your time, mate. I really appreciate it. We have you back in a couple of weeks on Nightlife, of course, when Phil is back in the hot seat. And you can contact Toby via email, advice@evcentral.com.au, if you've got some questions to go that way, because there were a lot we didn't get through.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.